Next up, a reading of the complaint filed by Jim Cox to the Texas State Board of Examiners of Psychologists. After which, we'll hear an interview with Andy Worthington about this case and other items in the news. Stay tuned.
This is a complaint to the Texas State Board of Examiners of Psychologists filed on June 16, 2010 by Jim L. H. Cox. The licensee involved in this complaint is Dr. James Elmer Mitchell. The conduct being reported, ethical violations, provision of services beyond expertise, violation of multiple standards. Background. In August 2002, at a secret prison in Thailand, a psychologist stood over a prisoner. The psychologist was James Elmer Mitchell. The prisoner was Abu Zubaida. Zubaida had been in custody since his arrest in Pakistan, March 28, 2002. Dr. Mitchell took over his interrogation shortly thereafter. He had ordered that Zubaida be chained to a chair for weeks on end, that he be whipped by the neck into concrete walls, that he be stuffed into a small black box and left for hours, that he be hung naked from the ceiling, that he be kept awake for 11 consecutive days and sprayed with cold water if he dozed. But the torture designed by Dr. Mitchell was about to pass to another level. It was time to implement the final stage of Dr. Mitchell's program. Abu Zubaida lay strapped to a gurney specially designed to maximize his suffering. His feet were above his head, just as Dr. Mitchell had ordered. His hands, arms, legs, chest, and head were restrained by heavy leather straps. As Zubaida lay helpless, Mitchell and his subordinates placed a black cloth over his face and began to pour water onto the cloth. Rivers of water ran up Zubaida's nose and down his throat. He could not breathe. Panic gripped him as he began to drown. And when Mitchell sensed that Zubaida dangled on the precipice between life and death, he ordered that the board be raised. Zubaida expelled the water in a violent, racking spasm of coughing, gurgling, and gasping. But before Zubaida could catch his breath, Dr. Mitchell repeated the experiment. Then he did it again. And again. According to the United States government, Abu Zubaida was waterboarded 83 times in August 2002 alone. Dr. James Elmer Mitchell is currently a psychologist licensed in the state of Texas. The road to torture in a Thai prison began 6 months earlier. After 9/11, Dr. Mitchell had approached the U.S. government with a proposition. Though he had never conducted an interrogation and had no training as an interrogator, and though he had no expertise in Al-Qaeda and no familiarity with the organization, and though he did not speak Arabic and had no training in radical Islam, Mitchell nonetheless said he could design and implement an interrogation plan for alleged Al-Qaeda suspects. Mitchell had taught U.S. soldiers how to resist unlawful interrogations and now offered to reverse engineer those principles and transform them into an act of, quote, enhanced interrogation techniques, unquote. The CIA took Mitchell at his word and paid him as much as $2,000 per day, plus expenses, tax-free. The U.S. government has now concluded that Dr. Mitchell misrepresented his qualifications, violated his professional duty to persons in his care, and acted without a legitimate scientific basis. The CIA Office of Medical Services, the OMS, with which Dr. Mitchell did not consult during either the design or implementation of the program, concluded that Dr. Mitchell misrepresented his qualifications and that, quote, there was no a priori reason to believe Dr. Mitchell's program was either efficacious or medically safe, unquote. The OMS has also concluded that there was no scientific basis to believe that the interrogation plan would produce reliable intelligence. Colonel Steve Kleinman, an interrogator with years of experience, testified to the U.S. Senate that Mitchell was, quote, stepping out of his area of expertise, unquote. The U.S. Armed Services Committee, which investigated the issue, found that Dr. Mitchell and his colleague, Dr. Bruce Jessen, were, quote, neither trained interrogators nor are they qualified to be, end quote. Michael Rowlands, former section chief of the FBI's International Terrorism Operations, described the methods employed by Drs. Mitchell and Jessen as, quote, voodoo science, unquote. The CIA terminated its contract with Dr. Mitchell in the spring of 2009. The psychological community has roundly condemned Dr. Mitchell. The Ethics Committee of the American Psychological Association, APA, for instance, issued a statement on June 19, 2009, stating that, quote, psychologists are absolutely prohibited from knowingly planning, designing, participating in, or assisting in the use of mock executions, waterboarding, or any other form of simulated drowning, physical assault, including slapping or shaking, exposure to extreme heat or cold, threats of harm or death at any time, and may not enlist others to employ these techniques in order to circumvent this resolution's prohibition. End quote. All of these techniques, of course, were designed and employed by Dr. Mitchell, who has never acknowledged the impropriety of his role or disavowed any of his actions. Dr. Mitchell remains licensed as a psychologist in the state of Texas. Dr. Mitchell has sullied his profession by violating the standards demanded by the Psychologists Licensing Act and the board's rules of practice. His transgressions fall into three categories. First, to achieve his ultimate plan of implementing a brutal interrogation and torture regime, Dr. Mitchell misrepresented his professional qualifications and experience to the Central Intelligence Agency. He also placed his own career and financial aspirations above the safety of others. Second, Dr. Mitchell designed this torture regime only by ignoring the complete lack of a scientific basis for the regime's safety and, assuming its safety, its effectiveness. In doing so, he failed to take reasonable steps to ensure the safety of others. Third, and most ominously, Dr. Mitchell himself tortured prisoners held in U.S. custody and directly supervised others who engaged in torture at his direction. The board's mission is to, quote, protect the public by ensuring that psychological services are provided by qualified and competent practitioners who adhere to established professional standards, end quote. Dr. Mitchell's behavior appears to fail to meet this standard. Dr. Mitchell's education and experience provided him no reasonable basis to believe he could design and implement an interrogation program. After joining the U.S. Air Force in 1974, Dr. Mitchell earned a Master's of Science in Counseling from the University of Alaska in 1981. He wrote his thesis on the effects of induced elation and depression on interpersonal problem-solving efficiency. In 1986, he received a Ph.D. from the University of South Florida, where he wrote a dissertation on, quote, the effectiveness of a high potassium/moderate sodium restriction diet and aerobic exercise as interventions for borderline hypertension. None of Mitchell's academic research involved interrogation, let alone the mechanisms for designing and implementing a safe and effective interrogation program. Following his formal education, Dr. Mitchell began his career as a psychologist at Fairchild Air Force Base in Spokane, Washington, in 1986. By 1988, he had become a SEER psychologist. SEER is an acronym for Survival, Evasion, Resistance, and Escape. The SEER training program is part of the Department of Defense Joint Personnel Recovery Agency, JPRA. This is a quote. SEER students are taught how to survive in various terrain, evade and endure captivity, resist interrogations, and conduct themselves to prevent harm to themselves and fellow prisoners of war." End quote. The program is designed to train soldiers at risk of capture and interrogation to defend and resist against torture. The U.S. Army, Navy, and Air Force have each developed their own version of the SEER program. SEER attempts to train American soldiers how to resist psychological pressure from an enemy who engages in unlawful interrogations. The SEER curriculum is classified, but SEER graduates and instructors have disclosed some of its methods. Prisoners are held in a mock prison camp where guards deprive them of food and sleep and subject them to repeated coercive interrogations. By May 2001, Dr. Mitchell had retired from the Air Force's SEER program. Later, he opened a private consulting company called KnowledgeWorks, LLC. But after the September 11th attacks, Dr. Mitchell saw an opportunity to sell his independent counseling services to the CIA. The CIA hired him to review a document known as the, quote, Manchester Manual, unquote, which described resistance training given to some members of Al-Qaeda. Dr. Mitchell contacted his former colleague, Dr. John Bruce Jessen, for assistance. Though they had no expertise or familiarity with Al-Qaeda, Mitchell and Jessen wrote a paper titled, quote, Recognizing and Developing Countermeasures to Al-Qaeda Resistance to Interrogation Techniques, a Resistance Training Perspective, end quote. But Mitchell did not content himself with claiming a false expertise in Al-Qaeda's resistance training. Though he had no qualifications as an interrogator, Mitchell, with Jessen, also marketed himself to the CIA as an expert in conducting counterterrorism interrogations of alleged Islamic fundamentalists. On their own initiative, they, quote, developed a list of new and more aggressive EITs, enhanced interrogation techniques, that they recommended for use in interrogations, end quote. They reverse-engineered SEER by recommending that techniques previously applied only in mock-controlled settings now be used in real-world interrogations. Among others, the EITs included the facial hold, facial slap, cramped confinement, confinement with insects, wall standing, stress positions, sleep deprivation, waterboarding, and sexual humiliation. Air Force Colonel Steve Kleinman, a former colleague at SEER who was also a career military interrogator with training in intelligence, stated that when Dr. Mitchell and Dr. Jessen became involved in CIA interrogations, quote, that was their first step into the world of intelligence. Everything else was role play, end quote. What Dr. Mitchell and Dr. Jessen failed to understand was they were stepping out of their area of expertise. Yet they nonetheless promoted themselves as offensive interrogation experts despite the, quote, disconnect between the SEER model, a resistance model, and an actual interrogation for intelligence purposes, end quote. By actively misrepresenting his professional qualifications, Mitchell violated the Psychologists Licensing Act, which prohibits a Texas-licensed psychologist from, quote, engaging in fraud or deceit in connection with services provided as a psychologist, end quote. Moreover, the Texas State Board of Examiners of Psychologists' Rules of Practice state, quote, licensees provide only services for which they have the education, skills, and training to perform competently, end quote. Dr. Mitchell violated the board's rules of practice governing competency when he went beyond his limited background to develop and implement the interrogation techniques. Moreover, in extending his independent contract with the CIA, Dr. Mitchell lacked professional objectivity by placing his own career and financial aspirations above the safety of others. In recommending a new and untested interrogation program of his own design to the CIA, Dr. Mitchell also violated the board's rule of practice requiring licensees to rely on scientifically and professionally derived knowledge when making professional judgments. Moreover, he failed to take reasonable steps to ensure the safety of others involved in this emerging field of psychology and interrogation. To understand the extent to which Dr. Mitchell violated these rules, it is essential to understand the stark difference between SEER resistance training and the real-world interrogation regime that Dr. Mitchell developed and implemented as a CIA contractor. In testifying before the Senate Committee on Armed Services, Colonel Steve Kleinman summarized several of the key differences between SEER mock interrogation techniques and real-world interrogations. The following is from Colonel Steve Kleinman's testimony before the Senate Committee on Armed Forces. To the non-intelligence officer, the transfer of SEER methods from the training environment to real-world operations seemed a logical option. Several critical factors, however, were overlooked. First, many of the methods used in SEER training are based on what was once known as the Communist Interrogation Model, a system designed to physically and psychologically debilitate a detainee as a means of gaining compliance. Second, that model's primary objective was to compel a prisoner to generate propaganda, not intelligence. Third, it was expressly designed to mirror a program that employed methods of interrogation considered by the West to be violations of the Geneva Conventions. The problems with employing SEER techniques in the interrogation of detainees do not stop there. I want to emphasize that survival instructors are some of the most dedicated professionals in armed forces. Their tireless work supports a noble mission to prepare others to return with honor. I would be remiss, though, if I did not make one point abundantly clear. Survival instructors are not interrogators. While interrogation and teaching resistance to interrogation have much in common, they are nonetheless profoundly different activities. Survival instructors operate in a domestic training environment and share both a language and culture with the students they teach. In contrast, interrogators are involved in worldwide operations and interact with foreign nationals across an often substantial cultural and linguistic divide. If questions arise about the student's veracity during role play, a survival instructor need only call the student's unit of assignment to verify the information. Clearly, this is not an option for an interrogator for whom detecting deception is a critical skill. While interrogation role play is limited in duration, frequency, and scope, interrogations of custodial detainees may last hours and continue over a span of months. The survival instructor's focus is not on information, but the performance of the student, while the interrogator must doggedly pursue and record every detail of intelligence information a detainee possesses. That ends our quote from Colonel Steve Kleinman. There are other differences between SEER and real-world interrogations. As the Senate Armed Services Committee observed, quote, SEER instructors are not selected for their roles based on language skills, intelligence training, or expertise in eliciting information, end quote. The committee's report continues, quote, typically, those who play the part of interrogators in SEER school neither are trained interrogators nor are they qualified to be. These role players are not trained to obtain reliable intelligence information from detainees. Their job is to train our personnel to resist providing reliable information to our enemies. As the deputy commander for the Joint Forces Command, JPRA's higher headquarters, put it, quote, the expertise of JPRA lies in training personnel how to respond and resist interrogations, not in how to conduct interrogations, end quote. That ends the quote from the committee's report. Furthermore, SEER school instructors receive extensive psychological testing prior to being hired, and they must undergo a year-long training process, annual psychological screening, and extensive monitoring and oversight during practical exercises in order to, quote, prevent instructor behavioral drift, which, if left unmonitored, could lead to abuse of students, end quote. At SEER schools, quote, instructors are constantly monitored by other JPRA personnel, command staff, and SEER psychologists to minimize the potential for students to be injured. These oversight mechanisms are designed to ensure that SEER instructors are complying with operating instructions and to check for signs that instructors do not suffer from moral disengagement, e.g., by becoming too absorbed in their roles as interrogators and starting to view U.S. military SEER students as prisoners or detainees. These oversight mechanisms are also designed to watch students for, quote, indications that they are not coping well with training tasks, provide corrective interventions with them before they become overwhelmed, and if need be, remotivate students who have become overwhelmed to enable them to succeed, end quote. In contrast to the year-long training that SEER school instructors receive, the CIA initiated a 2-week interrogator training course in November 2002 designed to train, qualify, and certify individuals as agency interrogators. This program included 1 week of classroom instruction and 1 week of, quote, hands-on, unquote, training. Another crucial difference between SEER and real-world interrogation is the level of controls employed to reduce the risk of physical and psychological harm to students during training, but absent from real-world interrogation settings. The Senate Armed Services Report states, quote, SEER school techniques are designed to simulate abusive tactics used by our enemies. There are fundamental differences between a SEER school exercise and a real-world interrogation. At SEER school, students are subject to an extensive medical and psychological pre-screening prior to being subjected to physical and psychological pressures. The schools impose strict limits on the frequency, duration, and/or intensity of certain techniques. Psychologists are present throughout SEER training to intervene should the need arise and to help students cope with associated stress. And SEER school is voluntary. Students are even given a special phrase they can use to immediately stop the techniques from being used against them. End quote. The SEER schools, including the Air Force SEER school where Dr. Mitchell worked, employ strict controls to reduce the risk of psychological and physical harm to students during training. These controls are absent from real-world interrogations. Moreover, the use of physical pressures differs between SEER school training and real-world interrogations regarding the use of physical pressures. From the Senate Armed Services Committee report. Because of the danger involved, very few SEER instructors are allowed to actually use physical pressures. It is extremely easy for U.S. Army instructors training U.S. Army soldiers to get out of hand and to injure students. The training, from the point of the student, appears to be chaotic and out of control. In reality, everything that is occurring in SEER school is very carefully monitored and paced. No one is acting on their own during training. Even with all these safeguards, injuries and accidents do happen. The risk with real detainees is increased exponentially. End of the quote. As Dr. Mitchell himself acknowledged, quote, the agency's use of the technique differed from that used in SEER training, end quote, because, quote, the agency's technique is for real and is more poignant and convincing, end quote. For example, the Inspector General's report explains that the waterboarding method used in CIA black sites was more brutal than the method used in SEER schools and described in the Office of Legal Counsel memorandum because the black site method used greater volumes of water and more obstructed breathing. Quote, at the SEER school and in the DOJ opinion, the subject's airflow is disrupted by the firm application of a damp cloth over the air passage. By contrast, the agency's interrogator continuously applied large volumes of water to a cloth that covered the detainee's mouth and nose, end quote. Moreover, whereas at the SEER school, quote, trainees usually have only a single exposure to this waterboard technique and never more than two, end quote, individuals interrogated in the real world post 9/11 were waterboarded dozens and sometimes hundreds of times. Dr. Mitchell intentionally ignored these critical differences of both environment and methodology in promoting his reverse-engineered SEER program to the CIA, as well as when personally applying the harsher waterboarding techniques to detainees. Even with the differences between the programs ignored, the U.S. Air Force and U.S. Army abandoned the waterboarding program at its SEER school because of its dramatic and dangerous effect on the students to whom it was applied. In sum, the SEER training environment simply cannot be analogized to the real-world interrogation setting. Dr. Mitchell neither consulted nor involved the CIA's Office of Medical Services, the OMS, prior to selling the program to the CIA. The OMS, in a subsequent review of the CIA's adoption of Dr. Mitchell's interrogation program, concluded that Dr. Mitchell did not have the expertise to develop an interrogation plan and that he misrepresented the medical safety of the program to the CIA and the Department of Justice. Further, OMS concluded that there was no proof, nor was there any reason to believe, that the EITs proposed by Dr. Mitchell would produce any sort of valuable intelligence from detainees as a form of interrogation. There simply was no scientific support for Dr. Mitchell's recommendations. At no time prior to implementing these programs did Dr. Mitchell conduct experiments, publish research about offensive interrogation techniques, or subject his theories to peer review in a publicly available forum. At no time did Mitchell establish that his techniques were safe and, if safe, whether they were effective in eliciting truth. One investigative report explained, quote, "In truth, many did not consider Mitchell and Jessen to be scientists. They possessed no data about the impact of SEER training on the human psyche," say former associates, "nor were they operational psychologists like the profilers who work for law enforcement, but they wanted to be, according to several former colleagues," end quote. Dr. Mitchell's failure to verify his interrogation regime using scientifically sound empirical methods therefore constitutes direct violations of the board's rule of practice requiring licensees to rely on scientifically and professionally derived knowledge when making professional judgments, and the rule requiring licensees to take reasonable steps to ensure the safety of others involved in emerging fields of study. Dr. Mitchell tortured prisoners in U.S. custody. The first was Abu Zubaydah, whose torture is worth recounting in detail. Abu Zubaydah, a Palestinian national, was the first detainee captured after 9/11 who was believed to be a high-ranking member of al-Qaeda. Abu Zubaydah was also the first person to be subjected to the new regime of abusive interrogation that Mitchell with Jessen designed and implemented. The CIA Inspector General report states that Abu Zubaydah's capture, quote, "accelerated the CIA's development of an interrogation program," end quote. According to former CIA Director George Tenet, once Abu Zubaydah was in custody, the CIA, quote, "got into holding and interrogating high-value detainees in a serious way," end quote. The CIA's lack of experience in interrogation may have made the agency susceptible to Dr. Mitchell's claims about the efficacy of his methods. Whatever the explanation, Abu Zubaydah's interrogation was used as an opportunity to test a set of experimental techniques devised by Dr. Mitchell that the United States had never before approved for use on its captives. On March 28, 2002, Abu Zubaydah was captured at a home in Pakistan by combined Pakistani and CIA forces. He was subsequently detained in secret CIA black sites located around the world, reportedly using facilities in Thailand, Afghanistan, Poland, and elsewhere. In September 2006, Zubaydah was transferred to the Guantanamo Bay prison, where he remains in U.S. custody. Abu Zubaydah was once described as al-Qaeda's, quote, "chief of operations," end quote, and a, quote, "trusted associate," end quote, of Osama bin Laden. The United States, however, now accepts that these accusations are untrue. The United States government no longer alleges that Abu Zubaydah was a member of al-Qaeda. The United States no longer alleges that Abu Zubaydah was an associate of bin Laden or a deputy in his organization. The United States no longer alleges that Zubaydah had any involvement in the attacks of 9/11 or that he had any advance knowledge that such attacks would take place. The United States no longer alleges that Zubaydah had any involvement in any al-Qaeda attacks on the United States or its interests at home or abroad, and no longer alleges that Zubaydah knew about any other attacks that may have been planned by al-Qaeda at the time of his arrest, March 28, 2002. Indeed, according to published reports, quote, within weeks of his capture, U.S. officials had gained evidence that made clear they had misjudged Abu Zubaydah, end quote. Despite the government's former claims about Abu Zubaydah, he has never been charged with a crime, either in a military commission or a civilian court. During the raid that led to his capture, Abu Zubaydah was shot in the groin, thigh, and stomach and suffered, quote, severe wounds, unquote. A medical team determined that he would die if not treated in a hospital. Abu Zubaydah was taken to a hospital, first in Pakistan, then at a black site in Thailand, where he spent several weeks being treated and where his initial questioning began. Zubaydah was initially interrogated using, quote, non-aggressive, non-physical, unquote, techniques. FBI agents questioned him and reportedly used traditional methods based on the Army Field Manual. According to one of the FBI interrogators who conducted these sessions, Zubaydah was cooperative. Soon, however, a CIA counterterrorism team arrived at the black site and assumed control over the interrogation. The CIA team included an outside contractor, quote, who was instructing them on how they should conduct the interrogations, end quote. This contractor was Dr. Mitchell. Deeming the FBI methods to be insufficient, Dr. Mitchell said they, quote, needed to diminish Abu Zubaydah's capacity to resist, end quote. Quote, immediately, on the instructions of the contractor, harsh techniques were introduced, starting with nudity, end quote. As time progressed, Mitchell moved, quote, further along the force continuum, introducing loud noise and then temperature manipulation, end quote. Abu Zubaydah was subsequently kept naked for between 1.5 to 2 months, and his clothes were provided or removed according to how cooperative his interrogators perceived him to be. He was also systematically deprived of sleep for a period of 2 to 3 weeks by the combined use of painful shackling, loud music, cold temperatures, and being doused with water. The cell was kept very cold by the use of air conditioning, and very loud shouting music was constantly playing on an approximately 15-minute repeat loop 24 hours a day. Sometimes the music stopped and was replaced by a loud hissing or crackling noise. As part of the regime of total control designed to strip detainees of their autonomy, Abu Zubaydah was denied solid foods. He was fed only high-calorie liquids, which provided him with minimal sustenance and left him constantly hungry. According to one of the FBI agents who observed the CIA's harsh methods with dismay, Mitchell, quote, insisted on stepping up the notches of his experiment, end quote, and devised the idea of placing Abu Zubaydah in confinement boxes. One box was too narrow to allow him to sit down. The other was so short that instead of standing, he reportedly, quote, had to double up his limbs in a fetal position, end quote. The coffin-like boxes were black both inside and out, and covered with towels, possibly in an effort to constrict the flow of air inside. While the CIA was inflicting escalating levels of abuse on Abu Zubaydah, he was still recovering from his gunshot wounds. In fact, the interrogators were so worried that Abu Zubaydah might die that they videotaped his interrogations in an attempt to protect themselves from potential liability. The CIA later destroyed these videotapes. As part of his mistreatment, Zubaydah was slammed directly into hard concrete walls, only later covered by a plywood sheet, with a thick collar placed around his neck that was presumably intended to protect him from additional life-threatening injury. He was also forced to stand with his wrists shackled to a bar or hook in the ceiling above his head and with his feet shackled to an eye bolt on the floor for more than 40 hours. This is widely regarded as one of the most painful physical torture techniques. As described by the Red Cross, prisoners subjected to this method are made to stand naked, held with the arms extended and chained above the head, for periods from 2 to 3 days continuously and for up to 2 or 3 months intermittently, during which period toilet access was sometimes denied, resulting in allegations from 4 detainees that they had to defecate and urinate over themselves. The infliction of this stress position contributed to the death of one detainee in the internment facility at Bagram Air Base. For Abu Zubaydah, this stress position technique was often combined with the cold cell technique so that he was left to stand naked and repeatedly doused with cold water in a cell kept near 50 degrees Fahrenheit. Mitchell and Jessen also worked to identify Abu Zubaydah's phobias. After discovering an especially vehement phobia that Abu Zubaydah suffered from, the psychologists devised a scheme to terrorize Abu Zubaydah with this fear. Quote, "You would like to place Zubaydah in a cramped confinement box with an insect. You have informed us that he appears to have a fear of insects. In particular, you would like to tell Zubaydah that you intend placing a stinging insect into the box with him." End quote. As many reporters have noted, this technique is reminiscent of an incident in George Orwell's novel 1984, in which the fictional government terrorizes the protagonist by exploiting his intense fear of rats. Finally, Zubaydah was waterboarded at least 83 times in August 2002, usually twice per session and sometimes 3 times in a single session. The Red Cross report contains Abu Zubaydah's own description of his waterboarding. His account describes how waterboarding was used to devastating effect in combination with the other abusive techniques described above. This is from Abu Zubaydah's statement. "During these torture sessions, many guards were present, plus 2 interrogators who did the actual beating, still asking questions, while the main interrogator left to return after the beating was over. After the beating, I was then placed in the small box. They placed a cloth or cover over the box to cut out all light and restrict my air supply. As it was not high enough even to sit upright, I had to crouch down. It was very difficult because of my wounds. The stress on my legs held in this position meant my wounds both in the leg and stomach became very painful. I think this occurred about 3 months after my last operation. It was always cold in the room, but when the cover was placed over the box, it made it hot and sweaty inside. The wound on my leg began to open and started to bleed. I don't know how long I remained in the small box. I think I may have slept or maybe fainted. I was then dragged from the small box, unable to walk properly, and put on what looked like a hospital bed and strapped down very tightly with belts. A black cloth was then placed over my face, and the interrogators used a mineral water bottle to pour water on the cloth so that I could not breathe. After a few minutes, the cloth was removed and the bed was rotated into an upright position. The pressure of the straps on my wounds was very painful. I vomited. The bed was then again lowered to a horizontal position and the same torture carried out again with the black cloth over my face and water poured on from a bottle. On this occasion, my head was in a more backward, downwards position, and the water was poured on for a longer time. I struggled against the straps, trying to breathe, but it was hopeless. I thought I was going to die. I was then placed again in the tall box. When I was inside the box, the loud music was played again, and somebody kept banging repeatedly on the box from the outside. I tried to sit down on the floor, but because of the small space, the bucket with urine tipped over and spilt over me. I remained in the box for several hours, maybe overnight. I was then taken out, and again a towel was wrapped around my neck, and I was smashed into the wall with the plywood covering and repeatedly slapped in the face by the same 2 interrogators as before. This went on for approximately 1 week. During this time, the whole procedure was repeated 5 times. On each occasion, apart from one, I was suffocated once or twice and was put in the vertical position on the bed in between. On one occasion, the suffocation was repeated 3 times. I vomited each time I was put in the vertical position between the suffocation. During that week, I was not given any solid food. My head and beard were shaved every day. I collapsed and lost consciousness on several occasions. Eventually, the torture was stopped by the intervention of the doctor. I was told during this period that I was one of the first to receive these interrogation techniques, so no rules applied. It felt like they were experimenting and trying out techniques to be used later on other people. That's the end of his quote. The Red Cross has concluded that many of the techniques inflicted upon Abu Zubaydah, whether used singly or in combination, constitute torture. Others constitute cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment. The Red Cross has also stated, quote, "The alleged participation of health personnel in the interrogation process and, either directly or indirectly, in the infliction of ill treatment constituted a gross breach of medical ethics and, in some cases, amounted to participation in torture and/or cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment." End quote. Regardless of what legal categories these techniques fall within, one conclusion is clear. A psychologist who helps inflict such cruel and shocking abuse on a defenseless human being would appear to have violated basic standards of the conduct of the profession. Dr. Mitchell not only enabled and participated in Abu Zubaydah's torment, he also personally designed the abusive and degrading techniques to which Zubaydah was subjected. In 2008, the American Psychological Association dropped its certification of Dr. Mitchell's company, Knowledge Works. The Ethics Committee of the American Psychological Association, APA, on February 22, 2008, issued an amendment to their resolution, quote, "against torture and other cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment or punishment and its application to individuals defined in the United States Code as enemy combatants," end quote. In this statement, the APA stated that, quote, "psychologists are absolutely prohibited from knowingly planning, designing, participating in, or assisting in the use of all condemned techniques at any time, and may not enlist others to employ these techniques in order to circumvent this resolution's prohibition," end quote, and set forth the following description of specific actions that constitute torture. Quote, "mock executions, waterboarding or any other form of simulated drowning or suffocation, sexual humiliation, rape, cultural or religious humiliation, exploitation of fears, phobias, or psychopathology, induced hypothermia, the use of psychotropic drugs or mind-altering substances, hooding, forced nakedness, stress positions, the use of dogs to threaten or intimidate, physical assault, including slapping or shaking, exposure to extreme heat or cold, threats of harm or death, isolation, sensory deprivation and overstimulation, sleep deprivation or the threatened use of any of the above techniques to an individual or to members of an individual's family," end quote. Dr. Mitchell is not an APA member. Discussing Dr. Mitchell and Dr. Jessen, Colonel Kleinman, an Air Force Reserve colonel and expert in human intelligence operations, found it astonishing that the CIA, quote, "chose two clinical psychologists who had no intelligence background whatsoever, who had never conducted an interrogation, to do something that had never been proven in the real world," end quote. Michael Rowlands, former section chief of the FBI's internal terrorism operations, described the methods employed by Dr. Mitchell and Dr. Jessen as, quote, "voodoo science." Speaking of Dr. Mitchell and Dr. Jessen, Steve Kleinman has stated, quote, "I think they have caused more harm to American national security than they'll ever understand," end quote. Dr. Mitchell repeatedly failed to abide by the standards of the Psychologists Licensing Act, the Act, and the rules promulgated by the board under the Act, the board rules. He violated the board rules governing competency, professional objectivity, basis for scientific and professional judgments, duties concerning emerging areas of psychology, professional supervision, improper sexual conduct, and exploitation of authority, research without informed consent, evaluation, assessment, and testing of a human subject without informed consent, as well as the Act's prohibition against fraud and deceit in connection with psychological services, and the Act's prohibition against violations of Chapter 81 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code for sexual exploitation by a mental health provider. Request for Board Action. I convey these observations and opinions to the board not only as a citizen, but in my role as licensee, mindful that I, quote, must report conduct by a licensee that appears to involve harm or the potential for harm to any individual or a violation of board rule, a state law, or federal law, end quote. I request board review of this matter and appropriate action. Jim L. H. Cox, Ph.D.